I'd like to start off with a little poem, a little essay that Dr. Bob Moorhead wrote. He's actually a pastor in the Overlake Christian Church. And I really can relate to this poem that he wrote because it's so relevant. It's called The Paradox of Our Times. I wonder if anybody heard of it?
Yeah?
Yeah, it's quite nice. So he writes, and this is in 1995, by the way, before internet and Facebook and broadband and NBN and everything like that. He wrote, "The paradox of our times. The paradox of our time in history is that we have taller buildings but shorter tempers, wider freeways but narrower viewpoints. We spend more but have less. We buy more but we enjoy less. We have bigger houses and smaller families, more conveniences, but less time. We have more degrees, but less common sense. We've got more knowledge, but less judgment and wisdom. We've got more experts, yet more problems. We've got more medicine, but less wellness. We drink too much. We smoke too much, we spend too recklessly, we laugh too little, we drive too fast, we get too angry, we stay up too late, we get too tired, we read too little, we watch TV too much, and we pray too seldom. We have multiplied our possessions, but we've reduced our values. We've talked too much, we've loved too seldom, and hate too often. We've learned how to make a living, but not a life. We've added years to our life, but no life to our years. We've been all the way to the moon and back, but we have trouble crossing the street to meet our new neighbor. We've conquered outer space, but not inner space." I like that. It's quite relevant in this day and age. And keeping in mind, he wrote that before, you know, internet and this technological revolution that we've experienced, so-called technological revolution. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, but it's very precise. Yeah, exactly. So you can see with technology, you know, in this day and age, it's pretty obvious that we've got much less time than before. We've become impatient because we've gotten used to having things so quickly, so instantly, you know. I can remember back then when we had dial-up modems, you'd be quite lucky if your page, your web page loaded in 30 seconds, you know. I think it was 14.4 kilobits. Now 30 seconds is unbearable. You're like, what the? And you check your phone and, you know, SMS somebody while your page loads, and you go, oh, I better change my broadband provider. Yeah, I pay them too much. We are so connected. Technology has made us so connected. But yet, at the same time, we have been isolated. Especially with Facebook, you know. You feel so in one with everybody. It's like your family. You know them so well. All 565 friends of yours. But I wonder how many of your friends, so-called friends on Facebook, you actually see. Have you called them up lately? You know, what's the quality? What's really the quality of our relationship? And we get so distracted, just so distracted, because technology has allowed us to have anything we want. With the click of a mouse, you can find out anything in the world, and you can see anything that you want. You can hear anything that you want. You know, you can be carried away by the latest orchestra or the latest, God forbid, Justin Bieber song that you like. I don't know. Anybody likes Justin Bieber? Yeah. So technology has done that. You know, it's done that to our lives, whether we are knowing, in relation to that, whether we know it or not, willingly or unwillingly, wittingly or unwittingly. It's happened to all of us. It's a silent epidemic that we are all experiencing. What's also interesting is the impact on work. for those who are working full-time or part-time, you realize that the nature of our work is no longer, as David Allen, he's a productivity expert, he said it's no longer a crank widget job. So before our grandparents, much of their work and much of other people's work involved cranking widgets. You make things, you work the field, you make pottery, you sell something, or you have a skill, you have a trade. And when you knock off work at 6 or 5, wherever, you know, you leave your work behind. But now, the nature of work has changed. The work is no longer a crank widget job, you know. It's all mental work. You have to think. You have to think of ideas. You've got to solve problems, you know, and so forth. I wonder anybody here has a crank widget job, worked in a restaurant, or, you know, delivered things, or, you know, something simple like that. Anybody here? I have. I can tell you, when I had the crank widget job working in a restaurant, it was the most amazing and happiest time of my life, because when you close the doors at 10 o'clock, I leave my work. It's all done for now, for today, at least. And, you know, you can go home and you relax. But now, because I'm working as an auditor, I take my work wherever I go. I've got a laptop, and we've all got a laptop here, I'm sure. So the ability to switch off work has become so much harder because we're carrying work wherever we go. So that's another impact technology has. And from that, there are two implications I've noticed. The idea of deadlines. So we've all got deadlines with mental work because, you know, it's no longer necessarily, you know, a certain time frame. You've got to get X done no matter what, you know. You've got to get X done. That's one aspect. Mental work means that also it consumes our psychic space, our psyche. It consumes our thought. It preoccupies our thought a lot, especially for those who are in IT, for example, you know. I remember when I was a programmer, a lot of the times, even downtime, you'd be thinking, oh, how do I solve this problem, you know? Is there a better way to come up with a procedure or program or develop an object that can actually solve this problem better? So inevitably, with this, we have this thing called stress. I like this photo, by the way. Who drew this? Good. 10 out of 10. We've got stress. And when the deadline comes around, I can tell you something. This stress turns into something else. It turns into this stress. Oh my God, it's due tomorrow. What am I going to do? I'm going to drink 2 cans of V and stay up late and all that type of silly things. Not all stress is bad, though. There's also another type of stress called eustress. It's a psychology term. But this is the stress, according to psychologists. They say it's the type of stress that actually prompts you to get things done. And it's a healthy type of stress. But there's a thin veil, they say, between eustress and distress. It's actually your perception of the object of your stress. You might think it goes that far, but no. But there are other things. While you're stressed, you get agitation. Oh, thank you. There's agitation, anxiety, restlessness, and all those negative emotions that you feel. But in the framework of Dharma, what the Buddha taught, these are all bound by something we call conditioning and habitual tendencies of mind. So I'd like to explore that a little bit in the talk, in the first part of the talk. And the second part is just learning how to deal with some of the more obvious types of stress. And then in the third part of the talk, maybe from a Dhamma perspective, Dhamma meaning in terms of what the Buddha taught, what are some of the techniques that we can apply in dealing with stress, distress, and even the minor psychic irritations that we experience from moment to moment. Now, I just want to be clear from the outset, in terms of stress and project-driven type of work, there are obvious things that you can do, and these might be just some of the things that we can obviously do to relieve that stress. And I might want to even solicit some ideas from you. I mean, in terms of being proactive with work, you know, just getting started on work earlier, it's quite useful. We hear some laughs at the back. Yeah, that sounds like a good idea at the time, but I don't know how. Yeah, I'll do it tomorrow, I'll get started next week, get started 2 hours before it's due. So in a way, you diffuse the bombs before they blow up, or scan the horizons for things that might blow up. It's quite useful. Deal with procrastination. I wonder if anybody's got, this thing with procrastination. I know I do. I do. Everybody's got that. Deal with procrastination. How do you deal with it? I wonder, anybody's got any ideas? Maybe you can help me solve my problems as well.
Set priorities.
Set priorities. Excellent. Yeah, that's great. Set priorities.
Never work.
What was that?
Never works.
Don't worry, you're not the only one, I'm sure. We've got a lot of smiles around the room. So, dealing with procrastination and setting priorities, it's, they say, there's a riddle that's related to this. They say, how do you actually eat an elephant? Well, that's the riddle. How do you eat an elephant?
Kill it first.
Pardon?
Kill it first.
Kill it first, yes, possibly. Yeah, so the only way to eat an elephant is one bite at a time. So, similarly, so I'm not saying you eat an elephant, but the logic behind that is actually you've got a massive project in front of you. The only way you can really finish that massive project is one task, manageable task at a time. So just breaking down that big project into manageable tasks. And setting priorities and time management. I mean, these are the basic skills we should have, really. I wonder if anybody would like to share some tips in terms of time management. I know some really organized people in this room. Yes? No? I mean, obviously, keeping a diary, yeah, might be helpful. Yeah? Pardon?
Write out to-do
list. Yeah, to-do list, yeah, excellent. And, there is this thing called the Pareto's principle. I wonder if anybody's heard of it. Pareto, 80-20 rule.
Yeah.
80-20? Mm-hmm. No? Basically, they say 20... How do they put it? Was it the 20-80 rule? I can't remember now. So basically, the most output of the work comes from the few basic tasks that you need to do. So just focusing on the basics, so to speak, and focusing on the bang per buck. So in project management terms, they say lick the frog first. So meaning to say, do all your big tasks first before you get sidetracked by little things. So just doing that. So here's just some of the ways. There's other ways also in terms of project management and also dealing with stress. In terms of the lifestyle that we live, none of us here take drugs or alcohol, but, just avoiding just the simple vices in life is quite helpful. I admit, actually, prior to learning about Buddhism and Dhamma, I used to be quite stressed working in a restaurant, and I used to take to alcohol a lot. So at the end of the night, the only way I could de-stress was actually knock down a bottle of red wine or have like 5 beers. That was my concept of stress. But really, it's just the way I saw it, and that And what made me reflect on changing that habit was waking up hungover the next day. Yes, not a nice feeling. But also the realization that when you drink, actually living on borrowed time, internally your organs are damaged. So your physical body suffers, and also it affects the people around you. So this is some of the few ways. Another way you could also deal with the obviously dealing with stress is just exercise. Physical exercise is quite good because it releases certain feel-good chemicals. It gives you motivation, you know, a lot of other things like that. So this is what I call the don't just sit there, do something approach. Do something. If you got this under your belt, I think I congratulate you because this is something that's ongoing. We refine how we do work as we actually do it. So it's a practice, similar to meditation and other things. You don't do it one time and you're perfect at it. You know, you learn from your mistakes. You learn as you go along and you fine-tune your skills. So that's the don't just sit there, do something approach. The other approach, which is quite interesting, and I'd like to advocate once you've gotten that down to a certain level of skill, is don't just do something. Sit there. That's really cryptic, is it? Don't just do something. Well, how do you spell it? Do something. Sit there. And what do we do when we sit there? Pardon? Relax. Yeah, relax. Learn to relax. Learn to observe this thing that we call our mind. Learn to observe this thing that we call our mind. All the saints and sages of the past, they always say, know thyself. Know thyself. But what do they mean, know thyself? Does it mean that I should know myself? My name is Zen Lo, I'm 60-something kilos, and I've got X amount of body fat, and, you know, I've got brown hair, whatever. Does that mean that way, or does it really mean something else, I wonder? Any ideas? Know thyself. Any ideas? From a Buddhist perspective, from a Dhammic perspective, the Buddha said that we can experience the whole of the universe within this thing that we call our body and mind. So to know thyself means to actually see clearly what this body and mind combination is made up of. To understand and know deeply, very experientially this phenomenon of body and mind. In the Buddha's language of the time, he called it ehi pasiko. Come and see, come and see. Come and see the teachings. Experience it for yourself. And the Buddha, in his most foremost teachings, described it very succinctly in four sentences, you know, those four noble truths. He said, we need to understand suffering. We need to understand stress. We need to realize and let go of the cause of the suffering and stress. We need to experience the freedom from it as the third noble truth. And as the fourth, we need to develop the causes and conditions for that freedom to arise. Understanding the suffering and stress and the cause is one thing. But it is what is the deeper underlying symptom? It is just a symptom, you know, of something deeper, much deeper than that. And I wonder if we have taken time out to actually realize what is this driving force of our lives. Any ideas? The driving force of our suffering of our and stress in our life. It's two basic energies of mind. It's the pushing and the pulling. So in the Buddha's discourse, he said, wanting or desiring for something, but yet not getting it, is suffering. And the opposite force, the pushing away or the dislike, and being with something unpleasant, you don't want it, but it's still there, that is also suffering and stressful. Just as a simple example, I was in a meditation retreat over Christmas, and I don't know how or why, but just this reoccurring thought came in my mind of an impending picnic I was going to have with my friends. And the thought, just a simple word came to my mind, dumplings. I wanted to make dumplings for the picnic, and I was hungry. It was, you know, that time in the evening where you don't have your evening meal and you're fasting, so you go, dumplings, oh yes, dumplings. I can see them, and my mouth starts salivating. Oh, and then my mind just goes off on a tangent. Zoom. All right, I'm going to get this ingredient, that ingredient. Here's how I'm going to cook it. Here's how I'm going to pack it. And my friends will all go, oh, wow, watch such nice dumplings. And then, you know, and then in this whole meditation, you're supposed to be meditating, observing reality as it is. But then you've just gotten carried away with this whole story that came from a single word. And then you go, oh, I'm supposed to be meditating. Oh, yes. So wanting something that wasn't there was so stressful. Just even thinking about dumplings was stressful. In the context of a retreat, obviously, because your mind is quite sensitive at that time. So, and my mind was thrown off balance because I got so agitated from that simple desire, you know, dumplings. You know, my mind, my whole meditation just got thrown off balance. And, oh, that was on day 3. Day 4, day 5, day 6, I just kept on thinking about dumplings at the same time. Oh, it was quite a struggle, actually. And lo and behold, such a useful Dhamma lesson. I came out of the retreat, right? Here's just an example of the opposing force that we experience, the pushing away, the dislike. I've made my dumplings, and just as it turned out, it never turned out the way I anticipated it to be. The dumplings got all sticky, you know, whatever, and things happened. And I was left, afterwards, or was it before? I ate too many. You know, initially, the first one was lovely, excellent. Oh, I got to have more of it. Second one, yeah, nice. Third one, fourth one, fifth one, the novelty wore off. I just didn't like it anymore. Same objects, yet, you know, I actually disliked it because now that I have fulfilled my object of desire and the desire wasn't there anymore, oh, I don't want it. Pass it on. It's actually two sides of the same coin, if you look at it. It's that desire and that pushing away. Once that desire is fulfilled, there's no desire anymore. You don't want it. So as long as we are not aware of this, and that completes the circle, that desire, that pushing away, and the not knowing, we are bound by this. We are bound by what they call, what is it called in Dhammic terms? Three poisons. Yeah? Craving, aversion, desire, and not knowing. Think of another example, maybe. And I'm sure we've all experienced this. For example, maybe your project deadline that's due in 2 weeks' time. Yeah. Yeah, some people are laughing, smiling. Can't wait to finish that project, right? What feeling comes in when that thought comes? Is it a pleasant feeling or unpleasant feeling? I wonder. Pardon? Depends on how much you have done. Excellent. And if you haven't done much, what's the feeling that comes in your body. Oh, damn it. I don't like this. It's an unpleasant feeling, right? Do you want to remain with that feeling? No, not at all. So immediately, you can see the Dhamma arising. Dhamma means truth. The truth that arises in the moment is, if you have an object of stress, and you are not aware of your habitual conditioning, your habitual reaction, and you react to it, it's just a very reflex action. It's a reflexive action of mind. Similarly, you know how you tap on the kneecap, it's how doctors test your reaction, whether you like it or not. It has become habit, such a strong habit that it's a reflexive action. So the characteristic is, the suffering that you experience is not proportional to the size of the project. It's proportional, your suffering, your stress is proportional to the attachment or the aversion that you have towards the outcome or the object. The bigger the attachment, the more the suffering. And also the deeper your conditioning, and the more that you are unaware of it, the worse it becomes. Yeah. So the whole process and the task for us to deal with this is through meditation. Meditation is so useful. As an exercise, it allows us to tune into the body, to tune into the mind, and to tune into whatever's happening at the present moment. I've broken it down into maybe some simple acronyms that hopefully we can all relate to. What does it mean for those people who are rolling on the floor and laughing? Excellent. We're all tech-savvy people here. No, it does not mean rolling on the floor and laughing. The first step is actually recognition. The second step is objective observation. The third step is finding out and investigating. And I will go into deeper what it actually entails. And the fourth step is learning to let go. I think recognition is quite important, to actually recognize whatever is happening at the present moment. And the power of mindfulness cannot be underestimated. I wonder, does anybody here have an understanding of what mindfulness is? Just throwing out the idea, mindfulness. Anybody can give me some definitions or how they have experienced mindfulness or practiced mindfulness? Anybody? Yes?
Being aware.
Being aware, yeah. Aware. Being aware. That's very good. What are the qualities of mindfulness? I wonder. Is it a memory of the past? Or is it an anticipation of the future? You're thinking of something? No. Yes, somebody's shaking their head at the back. No. So what is it? Is it?
Present moment.
It's present moment. It's present moment. Whatever's happening in the present moment. So there are other qualities too in what the Buddha said in the Satipatthana Sutta when you're practicing Vipassana meditation. There's also an element of clear comprehension. Oops, sorry. And there's an element of ardency. So similarly, kind of like just being keen, very keen to observe what's happening. It's not the very slack, oh, I'm going to sleep type of mindfulness. So here are just some of the main qualities that you will find with mindfulness. Now that helps in initially recognizing whatever has arisen. So let's follow through with an example, right? You've got an object of stress. You might be thinking, 31st April, that's when my assignment's due.
Uh-oh.
And that's 50%. Uh-oh. Right? So it's just a simple thought that comes to your mind. Applying mindfulness, a thought has arisen. Simple as that. A thought has arisen. So you observe it. You've been present in the moment. A thought has arisen. Or if you just saw it on the paper, okay, I've observed something. There is that recognition. You're mindful, right? The second step is an objective observation. And from the Buddhist Pali term, he means upekkha. Upekkha means equanimity. First, you have the mindfulness to observe whatever is in the present moment. But there is also an element of equanimity with whatever is arising. Can anybody describe to me what their experience of equanimity is? Or if you know what equanimity is? Or even just an idea that you've read somewhere, what equanimity might be? It's quite interesting. Any takers? No? Yes?
Health?
Pardon?
Health?
Oh, sorry, I couldn't hear that. Ellen? He's volunteering you.
Oh, Emily.
Oh, Emily.
Balance?
Balance. Yeah, that's good. Balance.
Not shaken by emotions.
Not shaken, unshaken. Yeah, excellent. Unshaken. The way I experience equanimity is also kind of like a silent observer. You're just a silent observer to the process of whatever's happening in your mind. There's nobody in the background bitching about, oh, this is such a terrible experience. This is such a terrible feeling. I don't like it. There is none of that. Because there is that keen awareness. Okay, what is happening right now, right here, right now? It's just a silent observer. And that's what we do in meditation a little bit. You might not realize it, but we are developing this quality of mind which is the silent observer of things. A few Thai masters also define equanimity as that is which is not shaken, which is a very good term. That means if something good happens to you, you're not convinced, all right, something good has happened, so what? Something bad has happened to you, you're also not depressed. All right, something bad has happened. There is also that objectivity to that experience. There's no, you know, you're not taking sides. You're not grasping for more. You're not pushing away. Meditation helps us to develop this objective observation because similarly as we have experienced earlier on, you remember how we were saying, whatever has happened, is happening, let that arise. If it's a short breath, let it be a short breath. Don't try to make it long. If it's a long breath, don't try to make it short. It is what it is. Just observing it. That's the reality of the moment. The third step, if you've got these two, it's already, you've come a very long way. Because with these two, equanimity and mindfulness, you've empowered your life so much already to actually have these two qualities of mind. Not only stress, you are you can also not only deal with stress, but all the vicissitudes of life, ups and downs, gain and loss, praise and blame. You're not shaken by it because you're not thrown around. You know how in a cyclone you've got this wind that's blowing you north, blowing you south. Anybody here been in a cyclone? No? Typhoon? Monsoon? Yeah. I'm from Fiji, so we actually have cyclones. We don't call them monsoons, but I think the effect is same. The wind blows at, you know, 100 and something kilometers per hour. We had one last year, and we've had a mango tree in Fiji. And the mango tree, big one, like 3 stories high, it just got blown down by the wind. So your mind is not blown around by the wind. The Buddha said, let your mind be like a rock that is unshaken by the wind. So learning to develop that quality of mind, that objective observation is so useful, so useful. The third step is finding out an investigation. Now, it's not that you have a microscope or, a detective lens and you're observing everything. In a way, you are, but it's not external. It's actually internal. The Buddha prescribed 4 dwellings or 4 areas of observation that we can, which is beneficial to our practice. He said, observe to learn body. Learn to observe your body as it is. Learn to observe your feelings as they arise and as they are. Learn to observe your mind. And learn to observe the mental qualities of your mind, or mental objects. And this is firmly based in the Buddha's discourse on the foundations of mindfulness, the Satipatthana. I wonder if anybody has heard of it, Satipatthana. It's a very good sutta, it's a Pali sutta, but it is common amongst all lineages in the Mahayana, Theravada, and also the Tibetan lineages. They all have Satipatthana, so it's something that's quite universal that the Buddha said you can actually practice. So learning to observe body as it is. Similarly, just as we've done in meditation, just learning to observe your body posture, of what it feels like to be in certain postures. There's a certain benefit to that if you actually practice it for a while, is that you are more aware of whatever's happening in your body. So you have that bodily awareness. Learning to observe feelings is another good thing, because you actually realize that you might have just an object of stress. In your experience, maybe there's an object, whatever it is. You might think, okay, I just have an object of stress, and then I just react. Alarm, right? But no, the Buddha said no. Learn to tune in to your present moment. Learn to feel what it feels like in your body to live in that stress. Learn to observe the feelings that arise in your body when you get stressed. I wonder if we've actually taken time out to take a step back and actually observe it. Because in our experience, if we are not aware of it, it's just, you know, there's an object, we are reacting. And it's all bundled up together, you know. It could be as simple as, oh, I really don't like this. And then the next train of thought comes, oh, yeah, it just feels terrible. You're actually feeling all these feelings. You feel, you might feel butterflies in your stomach. You might feel a certain tension here. You might feel... I wonder, anybody can share what their feeling is when they feel stressed out. Anybody here keen to share? I'm sure we've all been stressed out before. Pardon? You cry? Yeah, because maybe emotions just get too much. It's just too much. You feel like you need to release, let go. Yeah, that's normal. There's a lot of anxiety. I feel anxiety when there's a deadline. I'm like, oh man, how are we going to do this? I work in auditing, you see. It could be a 2-week audit squished into 1. So you're working like, oh, 8 o'clock, 9 o'clock, for example. You go, oh, how are you going to do this? So you feel anxious. Oh, you know, when you go to bed, oh, yeah, this is gnawing, like it bites into you. Gnawing sense of anxiety. I wonder if you've ever felt that. It's just maybe the term might be different, but the experience is universal. That bodily feeling, okay, this has arisen. Now that you are aware of it, now that you've got Dhamma on your side, you're not reacting to it now. You are present, you're mindful, you're objectively aware. Okay, this feeling has arisen in my chest. All right, let's observe it. Investigate it. How does it feel? What are the qualities of this feeling of anxiety? I wonder if anybody has taken time to actually do that. It's quite interesting, actually, if you actually sit down and observe it. Has anybody tried doing it? I wonder. It's quite cool. You actually realize that the feeling only arises for a moment. Does it stay forever? I wonder. Do you wake up going, oh, I have this anxiety, and then you carry that with you in your bathroom, in your kitchen. You sit down, it's still there. This is a massive lump in your chest. No, it arises, it flutters for a while, and then, all right, it goes away. You know, you sit down in the bathroom, you go think, oh, shit, I've got to do this. Then it rises again, all right, and then it passes away. You observe it, it passes away. You go, okay, and then you're observing it. You're like, okay, I'm just observing. You're not reacting. Previously, you know, without this knowledge, you're constantly reacting to it. I don't like this. Try to get rid of this feeling. No. The Buddha didn't prescribe you to reject your experience. He didn't say, don't reject your experience. He said, don't also crave for that experience. But just observe. Just observe reality as it is. Just observing reality as it is. That's why they say Vipassana meditation, which is one of the meditation techniques prescribed by the Buddha, is to see clearly. Vipassana means to see clearly in a certain way, in a very special way. Implicitly, actually, in all of this, what we're developing here is to separate the experience, the experience and the observer. You can actually learn to be an observer to your experience. I wonder if you've ever experienced or had an experience like that, to be the third person observer of your experience. It's quite interesting. You actually have an awareness which is separate to your experience. It's quite cool. Developing that awareness of that experience allows you to be more objective and not be so reactive. Anyways, so being aware of our body, one thing. Being aware of our feelings is another thing. And we've gone through great lengths with that anxiety example. Just being aware, the characteristic of our experience. From that previous example, you realize the characteristic of that experience, even with feeling, is it arises to pass away. So that's what it means. That's what the Buddha meant when he talked about anicca. Anicca, he said in Pali. Everything is impermanent. It's so impermanent. If you break down our experience, from this to that, no, it's not like that. You have an object. You have six senses from which you can perceive an object. And from that perception, feelings arise. And from that feeling, you make an evaluation. I like it, I don't like it. And from that evaluation, you react. The Buddha said, observe it. This is the psychological phenomenon, mind-body phenomenon that's happening all the time. We're constantly in this reaction, constantly. And that's one of the literal, I find, one of the literal meanings of samsara. Samsara, you might think, oh yeah, it's this metaphysical world where we are all dying and being reborn. You know, we go into the ground and we come back as a pig or something. I'm born in the year of pig, by the way. I like pigs. You might think, okay, that's samsara. No, but samsara also is your moment-to-moment experience. How you are living your moment-to-moment experience. You know, we are conditioning ourselves. If we react, say for example, I've got my deadline. All right, I don't like it. I just wish I can change my job. Oh, I just wish I can change this assignment. I can do science or something. You know, I don't like arts. For example. You know, so you have a deadline, then you have another object that you've created in your mind, and you make that loop. You're reacting, you're creating a new object, then you're reacting, you're creating a new object, you're reacting. All the time, we're constantly reacting. Unless we are aware of this, there is no hope. Sorry, no offense. There is no hope that we can actually come out of it. So, the promise of meditation, it's not airy-fairy, you'll become a deva in the deva realms and be an angel. No. The benefit is here and now. We're actually learning to observe the reality as it is. So, that's the task. The Buddha said, observe your mind. How are you creating your universe? How are you creating your universe? How are we living out our lives? Are we in constant reaction? Are we constantly evaluating good, bad, I like it, I don't like it, I push it away, I want more of it? That's the task at hand. He said, know if your mind has defilements and accept, all right, there is this mind that is defiled. Just observing, okay. Know if there is a mind that is angry. All right, I accept. There is anger. Know if there is annoyance in your mind. Accept it. All right. I'm mindful. I'm observing. There is annoyance. I'm feeling annoyance. That's okay. Annoyance has arisen. That's probably even a better way. Try to phrase it. Try to phrase your observation where you can actually take a step back from the experience. That's why when the Buddha talked about his first noble truth, he said, there is stress, there is suffering. He didn't say, it's my suffering. He said, there is something that has arisen. So learning, when you're investigating, try to use that. Use that phrase skillfully. There is something that has arisen. And be objective. Learn to observe it objectively. The fourth quality that we should keep track of is the mental objects. So whatever you experience in your mind, there's actually more than one thing that you can experience. In addition, and it's quite detailed, Abhidhamma, which is the qualities and the concomitants that can arise in your mind, and it's actually quite deep. I don't profess to know it myself. But know that there are factors of mind that lead to awakening, that lead to your happiness. And know that there are factors of mind that lead you away from it. So I wonder if anybody has heard of the five hindrances, for example? That is one of the sets or the qualities of mind that we should be aware of. If you realize, okay, there is this hindrance of ill will that has arisen. All right, I know that ill will has arisen. Fair enough. You know, that the mere acknowledgement and the knowing can actually get rid of that defilement if we're actually aware of it. If you have desire, just know. The Buddha said, just know. Just be aware that desire has arisen. Fair enough. Learning to observe mindfully and equanimously whatever has arisen in your mind. The mere knowing of it is good enough. And you realize all of these four qualities has the characteristic of arising and passing away. That's what the Buddha meant when he said anicca. Everything is anicca. And if you actually sit down and meditate and actually realize, to examine the quality of experience very, very deeply, not just superficially, but very deeply, not as an intellectual entertainment. I'm presenting this. I'm presenting to you a concept, and you have to remember it. No, learn to observe it. You know, learn to apply it. It's so useful. And then you realize for yourself, oh yeah, it is true. This thing that which I call myself, my ego, that I've built around me, this image that I've projected outwards, Zen, you know, accountant, or Zen, son, Zen, whatever, you know, is really nothing but a combination of all of these things. They arise, they pass away. They arise, they pass away. Feelings of love arise, pass away. Feelings of annoyance arise, pass away. Qualities of mind, anger arises, passes away. Greed arises, passes away. Just knowing that dissolves your ego, dissolves whatever attachment, strong clinging that you have. You realize, oh wow, very, very deeply, you realize very deeply, wow, there is no such thing, really. That's what the Buddha meant when he said, there's no such thing as a permanent self. No such thing. It's just aggregates arising, passing away, and the clinging that's associated with that aggregate. You might be clinging towards the perception of this thing called body. You know, it's not like I woke up one day 30 years old, you know, somebody waved a wand over my body and then I rose with white hair. No, no such thing. Constantly, our body is growing, decaying, and yet we get so attached to it, so attached to it. Yeah, I mean, can you imagine? I don't even know, have a quantity of how much the cosmetic industry is worth. Billions, tens of billions, probably hundreds of billions. Based around this perception that I can maintain this thing I call my body. But is it the nature of our body to remain the same forever? No, no such thing. It's dying this moment as I speak. Similarly with feelings, as I've discussed. It's this very nature is to arise and pass away. Very nature is to arise and pass away. So what use is it to cling on to something that will change? What use is it to try to dwell in a feeling and try to make it permanently yours? No such thing. It's on causes and conditions. Then you realize, oh, whatever I try to cling on to that is bound to change will cause me suffering. Whatever I try to cling on to that will bound to change will cause me suffering. Automatically, you realize, it's like fire. You realize you've been born holding this cauldron of fire, and you don't even realize you've been grasping onto that fire, and it's burning you. This thought, these thoughts of ill will, these thoughts of anger, you've been grasping it your whole life because you didn't even know you were born into it. We were born into ignorance, you know? Not ignorant because we're not educated and have a master's. No, we're ignorant to what the basic noble truths the Buddha was talking about. We're ignorant to that. And then you realize, oh, I can put this down. I can learn to put this cauldron of fire, this cauldron of hate, I can put it down. Even just for a single moment, if you learn to put down the attachment to your hatred, we're actually attached to our hatred. We are actually attached to our aversion. You might not even know it. If you learn to put it down, oh, such a relief. Such a relief. If we can only learn to practice, just learn to recognize. And that's why in meditation we learn to recognize those little pieces of calm, those little pieces of equanimity that we experience. We know that this is the benchmark of my experience. Okay, this is what it feels like to be calm. Just recognizing. And that's why the Buddha said it's a gradual path. There's no such thing as I wake up and I'm enlightened. No, no such thing. He said, Dhamma realization is like a shelf of an ocean continent. It slopes gradually, 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 and then there is that steep. So, he said, the Dhamma practice is a gradual path. Similarly, it's just learning to recognize those small moments of peace, small moments of equanimity, small moments of kindness, and small moments of compassion. We actually realize, oh, I have this capacity for kindness. I have this capacity for compassion. And then you realize, oh, my friend also is just like I am. He's not bad all the time, you know. He also has the seed of kindness, he also has, or she also has, the seed of compassion. We extend the practice outwards. So, starting from within, we extend our practice upwards. And then, sorry, I went off on a tangent, but then letting go is so natural. Once you actually sit down and investigate the nature of our experience, letting go and finding calm. The Buddha said, there is no higher happiness than peace. There is no higher happiness than peace. This peace he is talking about is the peace of mind where you're no longer holding on to your anger. You're no longer holding on to your desire. You're no longer grasping on to your experience. I hope we can all experience that peace, because I am 100% confident it's possible. And that is the possibility of all our practice here. So here's just my few thoughts and reflections on stress and how to deal with stress. So we've started from, don't just sit there, do something. Learning to deal with procrastination, being proactive. The things externally that we need to do to function. We're all lay people here. To do things, we have to be skillful. We have to know how to do things in terms of priorities, time management, deal with lifestyle changes that are more conducive to dealing with stress, exercising physically, but also learning to exercise mind. And learning to understand the conditions and the habits that we've developed in our mind, whether we are willingly party to it or unwilling party to it, so wittingly or unwittingly. So learning to roll on the floor and laugh a little bit at our experience. Or no. Learning to recognize with mindfulness, being aware of present moment with clear comprehension, knowing. Learning to objectively observe, being a third party observer to our experience. And then finding and investigating, just seeing what are the qualities of our experience in our body, in our feeling, and in our mind. And then, if we are serious enough in our practice, realizing the characteristic of impermanence is not a concept out there, but it's something that's really happening in this psychosomatic, psychophysical structure that we have, impermanence. And then, realizing that on a very deep level, we actually learn to let go. So that is something I'm just here to present today, and I hope you find a little bit use for that.
Do we have any questions? Really?
It's really hard, actually. It's really hard. I was a really angry person before. Just really, really angry. I was angry with everything. Angry with the world. Angry at my circumstance. Angry with my family. Angry with my friends. Just angry. But then, you know, realizing and waking up one moment, I actually have a choice. And that's such a beautiful moment when you wake up and you realize, oh, I have a choice to be angry. I have a choice whether to be stressed or not. Just realizing the possibility of a choice is so liberating. So liberating. And it reminds me of a story I heard once about this nurse who had to deal with this very difficult patient. He must have had a very bad life, this patient. He used to swear at her. He used to abuse her verbally. So ungrateful for this nurse. And the nurse would, because it's her job, she had to bear it. She's like, okay. But, you know, inside she held this grudge. So stressed by her work, you know, bad family relations. Coming home, she'd be angry with her husband because she had a bad day. And she said, one day I realized, and I woke up, I have a choice. I can deal and I can reciprocate that anger, or I can actually learn to deal with this person in a more kind way. And that changed that patient, actually. And I found, wow, such an amazing thing to actually realize you have a choice. So I hope you've taken something useful from this talk. That's what Dhamma practice is all about. It's right here, right now, dealing with the problems of our lives and realizing we have a choice. And in this, you learn how to actually observe the body, observe the mind. And within that moment, those moments of equanimity are so powerful. Those moments of mindfulness are so powerful. It's like, as one of my teachers put it, you're driving your miles at 100, driving your car at 100 miles an hour. But those moments of equanimity and mindfulness just presses on the brake a little bit. You might go, you know, for 10 kilometers before it stops. You know, it's carrying on its momentum, the momentum of your stress or the momentum of your anger. It's going, you know, 10 kilometers before it stops. But then those moments of mindfulness and equanimity just breaks it down a little bit, So it'll stop in maybe 70 kilometers. So instead of being stressed out continually, you know, when you're doing your project, you realize, oh, actually, I have these moments where I'm not stressed. And those are very beautiful moments, because 1 minute of calm mind turns into 2 minutes of calm mind, turns into 3 minutes, 4 minutes, 5 minutes, 10 minutes. And there might be a moment in your life where you realize, oh, it's, they call it mind like water. And anybody has heard of that term, mind like water? Yeah, I see some nods. But the concept of mind like water is being in a state of mind where, what happens when you throw a stone into the pond? It goes psh, right? Yeah, it ripples, and then calm again. The water does not go rock, and it dodges. No, it doesn't. It doesn't. It doesn't do that. It doesn't react. See, equanimity, mindfulness. And see, the water is very mindful and equanimous. It's like, okay, rock, whatever. Splashes out, okay, it ripples, and then it calms. So developing the skill, it's a practice. It doesn't mean that you wake up one day and you're fully enlightened or anything. No, it's a continual practice. You learn to develop mind like water. Initially, you might be boiling for like 5 hours. That's okay. Boiling. But it will grow calm. But I can attest to you, it's definitely possible. And it's something that you have to take keen interest in. It's a skill that you develop. And you can only develop skill if you have a keen interest. And it's such a worthwhile skill too. Much more worthwhile than learning how to play World of Warcraft or, I don't know, whatever people play nowadays. Oh, I see some finger pointing. All right. Oh yeah.
Once you touch it.
Yeah.
What you said, you remind me that I caused most. When you play a game, you're kind of supposed to relax, but online game sometimes just make you even more stressed.
Yeah, I can attest to that because I'm guilty of that too. I just gotten to a point where I'm like, no, this is not doable. I just deleted my account. Like, okay, bye, see you. And now it's to the point where I don't have a TV at home. I'm so happy without a TV because it's just one less thing I have to deal with. So, making lifestyle changes, whatever's conducive, you know it's good for you, but, you know, it's short pain in the beginning. I hope you've got some questions because it's quite an interesting topic.
With what you just said a moment ago, with the lifestyle and having no TV, how do you be with society then?
Oh yeah.
A bit weird.
Yeah. Well, you're still connected. I mean, you can check SMH and check Gmail, whatever. They've got TV online now if you really, really need to watch something. But I find that purely from an efficiency point of view, because I'm an efficiency geek, to absorb information, it's just quicker to read it than to sit there in half an hour to, you know, hear somebody yap about. That's purely my point of view anyway.
Depends on how you use it.
That's true. That is true.
Like before, I was high school. I just watch the Chinese news in the SBS in the morning, and then watch English news in Channel 9. Because this is all I watch.
Yeah, that's great. I mean, knowing how to use it and having the discipline, it's very good. Being skillful. The Buddha always said, you know, learn to be skillful in your actions, knowing the causes and conditions, knowing the effect, and being skillful in your choice when you make decisions. He always recommended that. Any questions on my funny acronym? Forgive the pun. Yeah, Dhamma is so amazing. So amazing. And we're so fortunate. So fortunate. Especially here in Unipads. Because we have access to so much resources and to so much support. Without the rites and the rituals and the paraphernalia of religion, you know, just learning to experience the flavor of Dhamma. The Buddha said, the taste of Dhamma is the highest of all taste, because to actually experience it is to experience the happiness that he talked about. And that's priceless. Forgive me, MasterCard, for ripping off your slogan. It's priceless. So you're saying when you need to plan something?
Yeah.
Okay. Yep. No, it's great. It's a really good question, because because when you're doing that thing, you're planning, your mind is not present. You're using, is it the left side, right side? Is it the creative side of your brain, whichever side that is? Right. Okay. You're using your right side of the brain where you're placing yourself in a hypothetical situation in the future. You've got these things to do. That's great, because being mindful means that when you're planning, you're only planning. You're not having 10 tabs on your Chrome browser, and you're doing one thing at a time, chatting on Gmail, checking your Facebook, planning in your diary, watching TV, and chatting to somebody at the same time. That's the danger and disaster of technology. But yeah, so when you're planning, you're just planning, like, and just as something that's useful, I found in my readings is actually writing things down. Like for me, I'm a visual person, so I like to empty my mind on a piece of paper and then organize around that. So capturing your thoughts in some kind of media, I find is quite useful, because a lot of the psychic irritants that we're facing in our daily lives is that nagging voice in my mind that tells me, yes, I really should put up that clock I meant to do. You know, so if I write it down, it absolves my responsibility of having to do it. So, okay, yeah, I've got it on my task. All right, I don't think about it anymore. But no, seriously, if you write it on a list and you empty your mind and you're planning, and you're really planning, not distracted, then that's fine. I mean, it's something you need to do. We're all, you know, lay practitioners. We have future to think about, tomorrow to think about.
I guess if we don't have, do we have any more? You guys?
Yes.
For example, when we are angry, right?
Yeah.
What's the difference between letting go and ignoring?
Ignoring.
Like ignoring the anger or let go of the anger? Are they the same or different?
I think there's a difference between the two. If you're ignoring your anger, there is an element of suppression. So with that energy of mind that you have, it is the same energy you're trying to squash it. It's like, I don't like this. Put it away. Or you're distracting yourself. So you're using that same energy against your anger. And really, it doesn't get rid of your anger, because you think you might have gotten rid of your anger. But the next time you just need to think about this person, and then it just pops up again. You know, it's like, have you experienced that? You think you've let go, but the moment you've thought of that person, oh, I wish I could get a piece of him. It's like that, yeah. So you thought you've let go. You've thought you've, you know, put it away, but you've just actually suppressed it. So it remains in your psyche. It remains as part of your conditioning. It's still there. So letting go is actually, though it could be as minute of a process as that, the Buddha said not only you can practice that way, another way to practice is actually reflect. To reflect on the drawbacks of this emotion that you're feeling. Okay? So when you do that, you reflect, okay, my anger has overtaken me. You know, it does not really lead to good result. Maybe I should talk to this person another time. It could be a simple reflection like that as another form of practice. The Buddha recommended that to his son Rahula. He said, he told Rahula, Rahula, if, before you say something, and he was so pragmatic. He said, Rahula, before you say something, reflect. Is this something that you're going to do leading to bad consequences or good? Reflect on that. He said, if it's bad, then try to refrain from it. Refrain from it. If it's good, you can carry on with the act. And then he told Rahula, while you're doing that act, also reflect. Is this something that'll lead to good consequences or bad consequences? And then after you've done that act, was it something that led to bad consequences for yourself and others? Then resolve not to repeat that act again. So, you know, reflection is also a way to deal with it as well. So not only letting go. Sometimes it's hard to let go, especially when you're caught up in anger, yeah? Because anger arises so quickly, so instantaneous. So learning to have other skillful means, and even distraction is maybe a lower form of dealing with it, but it also works. Maybe distracting yourself or just diverting your attention for the moment until your anger subsides, and then you can learn to observe a little bit more deeply into the experience. But if you feel, okay, my mindfulness is quite strong, and then you just observe, okay, anger has arisen. It feels like a tightness in my chest. I'm a third-party observer. This is what it feels like. These are the feelings. These are the thoughts. Okay, that's fine. Anger has arisen. Let's see how long it stays. You realize anger arises just for a few seconds, and then it disappears for a few seconds, and then it rises again. Your heart rate becomes faster. You get flushed. You know, thoughts of ill will come into your mind. Then it passes away, and you can observe it without reacting. It's hard, but it's doable. Yeah. I don't know if that answers your question.
Yeah.